Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when I am on the air.
This is MJ Network, and we're waiting for the author to call in, and I'm going to attempt to call him right now and see whether we can get Bo Wagner.
Hello, please state your name after the tone, and Google Voice will try to connect you.
Hi. Hello. This is Fran Lewis, and obviously my the person that's supposed to be on my show did not call in. I'm trying to call him.
Hello.
Right now.
Please state your name after the tone, and Google Voice will try to connect you.
This is Fran Lewis. I'm looking for Bo Wagner to be on my radio show this morning.
Hi, Fran. This is Bo.
Hi.
Hello?
Fran, are you there? Hi, it's Fran.
Yeah, I'm here. Yes,
oh,
I am here.
Okay, finally. Good. I was getting worried that I had dead air here. That's why I
called
you to make sure.
Yep, well, I'm glad you did. I just tried to call you, and then, of course, I was having trouble connecting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so... this is talking about A Network Exposed, which is an interesting book. And why did you decide to go into law enforcement, and what areas did you work in so that you created this novel? It seemed like it was really happening as I read it.
Yeah. Well, it started out as my mom. When I was a child, my mom was the secretary for the chief of police. And, you know, and law enforcement officers and their service to the community were a positive influence. And, you know, for me during my childhood, so it's understandable that as I grew into my adult years, I would follow in the footsteps of my role models and mentors. And throughout my career, it was my privilege to help serve and protect the communities and our way of life. Because, you know, I've always felt that if you weren't part of the solution, then you were part of the problem. Because if you just stand silent and do nothing, then nothing will happen. But, you know, law enforcement was always, I guess, what I, you know, my chosen career, even from a childhood standpoint. And I worked everything from patrol to general detective in the CID. Then from that, went into narcotics investigation. From that, led me into undercover work. I was loaned out for undercover operations, and after that, when I finished the undercover part of it, I was pulled out and was made the director of the Vice Narcotics Unit and also the commander of the SWAT team, and I followed that course through it until my retirement.
Well, that is amazing. That's funny, because my mother told me when I was 3 I was going to be an educator and a reading and writing specialist. Yeah. That's my thing. Reviewing books and stuff I started to do when I retired from teaching when my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. But my passion is I love reading. So I was a reading and writing. I work with kids with learning disabilities in a Bronx school. And it's phenomenal because they still tag me on Facebook to let me know what they're doing. So
yeah.
Tell us about why narcotics, and how does somebody work undercover and blend in with the criminal so that no one knows it's you. I've read about thousands of books, and this always fascinated me, how somebody is able to do it and nobody really notices them. So how do you do that?
Answer to the first part of your question, you know, why narcotics? Like I said, I was in general investigation, CID, and the opportunity to go into narcotics interested me, and it came available. So as I, it just kind of one step led to the other. And I was doing general investigations as far as narcotics going and doing the investigative side of it. And I was being successful at it, so I was approached about doing undercover work. And, you know, I was hesitant at first, to be honest with you. That was a new venture for me, but I accepted the challenge and the opportunity. And as far as how do you blend in, well, every situation is different. You know, you start off by adapting your appearance so that you blend in, you know, hair, clothing, et cetera, like that. And each situation would be different. It's what kind of crowd are you trying to fit into? The situation that I was put into, I was sent to try to infiltrate and target the street gangs and biker gangs. So my hair and clothing had to reflect that. And, you know, you start at the bottom. In narcotics, yeah, it usually means on the street level pushers. That's your bottom level. The formula for success is really not that complicated, because drug dealers are in it for the money. So you start at the bottom, and then, you know, over the period of time, as you make regular buys to the pushers. And the key point here is that, you know, if you're in it for the long haul, and you're wanting to, you know, reach the top, you're looking more than just getting the corner pusher off the street, then you don't make arrests. You document your buys. It's like any other investigation. You document everything. In my particular situation, I had my vehicle that I was using had cameras in it, so everything was documented. Everything, you know, I was obviously wired for sound, so we had both video and audio. I was set up in an apartment complex in the target neighborhood, and my whole apartment was wired. Any room that you would go into, which most of the time when, as the operation continued and grew into the later stages, I would have the suppliers come to my apartment, and we would do deals inside the apartment. But everything, like I said, everything was wired. I had microphones all through the apartment. I had cameras that videotaped every transaction. So, you know, that's key, because you got to have an overwhelming amount of evidence when it goes to trial. So you have to dot every I, cross every T. So, but anyway, you just don't make arrests. And then as you build confidence and they build confidence in you and things, and you start making larger buys, you start going from your small amounts to the larger amounts to the extremely large amounts with a lot of money. And that's when you reach the top of their chain, because when you get to the larger amount of money and the larger amount supplies, the guys in charge, the people at the top, you know, they want to take the full cut. They don't want to share it with the people below them. So when you start getting to that level, you're dealing more with the people at the top, which was made our operation very successful.
They didn't realize when they came in that there were cameras or videos or anything. They didn't even notice it. They didn't even
And now I did, when we were doing things inside the apartment, I did not wear a wire because I was checked several times. But with the whole apartment wired, with hidden microphones, hidden cameras, throughout the thing, I did not need to be wired. Because everything was, because inside the apartment, everything was being recorded anyway.
Well, I'm reading this book. I have it in front of me, by the way.
Okay.
Usually by now, when the book weighs more than I do, I weigh 108 pounds. This book weighs more than me. And I said, like, okay. The storyline is that the police department, it happens in the news that they're corrupt at times. That's one of the primary parts of the storyline in this book. So how did you create the characters? And the reason why I thought originally that it was really happening is because you're one of the characters in the book. How come you did that? That was really clever. It makes it more real.
Yeah, and that was my intent. Is I wanted to reach the people that not only the people that's in law enforcement that would be familiar, but people like yourself that have a general knowledge and, you know, things you see in the news, movies you see. But I wanted to make it real and, you know, at a high level of realism and believability that they could connect with it and draw them into it so that they actually felt like they were there, they were part of it. And I used the benefit of my experience and my 20 years of experience in law enforcement, to make that believable. And, I would stress it again that, you know, it is a work of fiction and things, but there are certain elements of the book that I relied on actual experience and things, and I was able to weave that between fiction and realism to make it a believable work.
No, it was, and I just posted. I'm gonna put this. I just posted the summary of the book and some other information about it on my Facebook wall. I'm a very popular person. It's scary. And,
well, that's great.
Yeah. It is, yeah. Everybody, you know, it's funny because I post something on my Just Reviews and they're like, okay. And like 5 minutes later, everybody reads it. And I'm like, how did you know I just posted that? Yeah, what can I say? Sometimes you just get lucky.
I think that would also be credited to you for your hard work and the time and the personal professionalism that you put into your job that draws your reader base and your listener base and people that do follow you because you keep it interesting.
I hope so. I'm doing some, I'll announce it after, but on Thursday, it's going to get really difficult. Yeah, it's going to be different. Wednesday I have Cindy McDonald. We're going to bring back her character of Fiona Quinn because we had technical difficulties last time. But on Thursday, former FBI agent Michael Tabman and I, we're going to tackle the government shutdown, the wall, and the FBI investigation of Trump. Those are three of our topics.
Right.
Oh, yeah, that's just the start. And he texted me this morning, and I'm going, I have to look that up now, too. And, yeah, I've got my questions and talking points, but I'll point out. So it should be interesting. So tell us how you came to handle and oversee the first case. What I was really impressed with is that when you met all the people involved, all the police officers, the chiefs, and all of them, how everybody worked together. And I'm wondering, is that true in real life? So how come you came to oversee the first case involving different counties dealing primarily with marijuana sales and drug trafficking? And that's an important topic because there are many states that want to legalize it, and there are some that don't want to legalize it.
Right. And the reason I chose marijuana as the primary initial focus is that, from the general public standpoint, everyone is aware of or has some familiarity with marijuana. It's something that everyone can relate to. You start talking some of the other drugs like meth, fentanyl, things like that. People may have heard of it, but they're not really that familiar with it, so you're not talking a familiar topic. So I wanted to keep it a topic that everyone could relate to. From one standpoint or one relation to another. The plot of the book is set in the South. And in most of the southern states, marijuana is very prevalent due to the longer growing seasons, the warmer climate. You know, and it doesn't take a lot of expertise. lab work and chemical work, things like some of the fentanyl, some of the things like meth that requires a higher level of expertise to produce. Marijuana, basically, especially if you're doing it with an outdoor grow operation, basically all you need is, you know, the plants, fertilizer, and the seeds, and water, and you know, like any other plant, it does the rest. So that was my primary reason for choosing marijuana and things. As far as dealing with the law enforcement and how easily me and the in the story, how easily me and the other officers meshed, it's like with any job. I mean, you know, you start, you go into a job, especially a new situation like that, you're going to come across people that are very easy to work with. And then there's other, then you encounter others that are, require a little more of a challenge. We'll leave it at that. That's not just, you know, so that's true in any walk of life or any job. It, you know, there are some that you are able to interact with, and through your years of and time working together, a definite sense of camaraderie is formed, and to the point that it's almost like a marriage. You know what the other person is thinking. You know how they're going to react. You know what, you almost can sense what they're feeling and what their suspicions are, and you grow upon that with each other. You feed on that with each other, because in a team situation like with the task force in this book, is that every member of the team is integral and important. You know, you have different responsibilities, different level areas of expertise, and this the coming together and of a blending of all of those personnel and all those experiences and all those expertise that makes a team successful.
Well, I was impressed with them, and it really is too bad in real life that people don't always get along and work together.
And there are successful teams everywhere. And through my career, I encountered many successful teams, and I was part of those successful teams and things. And then, even though these characters themselves are fictional, there are real life examples in every area of law enforcement throughout the country. And, you know, a lot of times, especially, you know, I try to stay out of the political side of it, but over the past few years, you know, through the media and things, there have been some negative aspects of law enforcement where people see, you know, some questionable situations and things, and it doesn't always project the law enforcement field and the people in law enforcement in a positive light. And I would want to stress that there are a lot of good officers out there that put their lives on the line every single day, every minute of every day. And, you know, just because it's like any other thing, you see bad examples and good examples of everyone in every walk of life. And I would, your listeners and the people that hear this, I would want them to know, yeah, there's some people that in law enforcement that makes questionable decisions, makes bad decisions. There's also a lot of officers out there that put it on the line every day and are a shining example in their community.
I agree with you. In every walk of life, in every job, there are great people, there are teams. And for 36 years, I work with some really great people and some really not so great people. You do. You get that. You just have to pick and choose and be careful. So
exactly.
You created this test book. How did you pick your teams and the counties that they came from? And, of course, I have one favorite character. That would be Sandy. She really is integral in this book, seriously.
Okay. And that was, as far as addressing the thing with Sandy, that was actually very deliberate. I've had the privilege of working with some really exceptional female officers throughout my career. And sometimes I think that their contributions and their service is sometimes understated or even overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was designing the characters of this book and the team, I wanted there to be a female officer that was very prominent share an important role in the team to illustrate that there are some really great female officers out there. And, you know, and as the team grew, you know, I also included additional female officers and things throughout the team. I guess what I'm saying is that I wanted it to be real life. I wanted to, you know, show the world and show the people that read my book that there's some really, really exceptional female officers, and it's not just an all-boys club, that they're, you know, some of the best partners I ever worked with were female, and I can't state that enough.
You know what I found easy, too? If anybody ever wanted to write a book with police procedures or write a, you know, a book typical like, you know, like this and dealing with the police force, the way you handled each situation was so easy to follow that they could actually copy the correct procedure for how to handle situations. You know, how you go in, how you identify things, how you, you know, go the procedures to follow when you're going to get somebody that's, you know, you're going to arrest. I sat there, I said, like, okay, I can figure this out. This is really good. I understand. So this is like sort of like a go-to guide, I would say, for people that want to actually, you know, write a book and have it credible. I mean, that's what I found is impressive.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate it, and I hope all your listeners that have not purchased the book yet will, because I wanted to keep the book interesting from the very first pages. You know, as with any book you've got, there's a section of the book that you have to do establishing your characters, establishing the plot, mm-hmm. establishing the storyline, which sometimes can drag out, be a little mundane, but I wanted to start the book on a high note and things, and then let it build in a realistic sense, and realize that you don't walk in the door the first day and that everything is just laid out in front of you, that there is a process. And as you come across things that are questionable, you know, you start asking questions. Okay, is this just someone being stupid, or is there more to this than that? And so you put that in the back of your mind. You make your documentations, because as you know, anyone that's in the field of law enforcement or any other field, I had a key role in one of the things that in my book, you know, I had Wagner's rules, and those are actually rules that I set up and followed. And one of them is that if it is not documented, it never happened. Because when mm-hmm. it comes time for court and prosecution, you know, you can think, you say, well, I remember this, I remember that. But if it isn't documented, dates, times, and allowed, and also accompanied with collaborated evidence, when it gets to court, it's just going to be thrown out as hearsay.
I know. I just finished reading something that's phenomenal. John Lesquois, The Rule of Law. And what happens when the DA is corrupt and things they disappear. That's
yes.
even scary. When you have an evidence, and you know you brought it in there, and you know it was there, you know you have the lift cards from the fingerprints, and you know you have everything, and all of a sudden the wrong fingerprints are on something and something happens. Cool.
And so, you know, as with anything, whether you're talking law enforcement, whether you're talking, you know, corporate life, settings, you have checks and balances, and hopefully those are in place. And it goes back to everything's got to be documented. And when I was working throughout my career, I was, you know, I was meticulous almost to fault. People constantly accuse me of being too anal or too meticulous. But, you know, I argue that I don't think that you could be that. I don't think you could be too meticulous, because you don't want someone, if you work so hard to build a case and to bring, you know, whether it be a drug dealer or a person, you know, doing a burglary ring or whatever, and you bring them to trial, you don't want them walking out the door on the technicality.
Mm-hmm.
So you dot your I's, you cross your T's, you make sure that you got an amount of preponderance of evidence and things, and collaborated evidence and tangible evidence, that when it goes before a jury, you know, they can actually see it. They can feel it. They can put their hands on it. They can see the pictures. They can hear the recording. You know, that for a jury, jury member, that brings it personal to them. They can relate to it. They can see it, they can hear it, they can touch it, they can relate to it.
I see what you're saying. Now, the other character that I liked is Frank. How come he agreed to be your assistant director and his input was valuable? And how did you proceed in choosing which counties to address? He was an interesting character. He was loyal.
We'll start with how do I choose the counties. It was in the book, it was set up as the agency received several requests from administrators within the region of Western North Carolina asking for assistance as they were seeing an elevated amount of trafficking and drug use and things and in their area, and they were asking for federal assistance because a lot of times, and this is true in reality, is a lot of times, especially with state and local authorities, they have the restrictions of jurisdiction. They can only operate within their jurisdiction, whether it be local, like a sheriff's department, they can only operate within their county unless their investigation leads to another county. And then they have to try to build, get authority and do a agreement between counties and things. And so a lot of times when you start dealing with multiple counties, especially if you're crossing state lines, you have to get the federal authorities involved. But how do we choose this area? Is that we were receiving a large amount of requests from the administrators in Western North Carolina requesting assistance. And so Agent Wagner went to that area and started going to all the different administrators who had requested assistance and asking, specific questions. Do you have a specific area? And, because you can't just walk in and say, well, we got a problem in our county, especially if you're talking marijuana. Most outdoor marijuana, aerial surveillance is key to a marijuana eradication operation because you got to be able to spot it. And you can't fly over every square foot of the county to look for it. So you rely on the local agency, their intelligence and their tips that they've had from informants as to specific areas where they want to start their search and target. So in the book, Agent Wagner went to the different administrators and from his interviews with them, McDowell County had the most specific information. They knew they had very specific areas pinpointed on and were able to show Agent Wagner and his team on the map, here's this area, here's this area. So that is how McDowell County was chosen as the starting point. And that's typical in real life too.
Wow, that's unbelievable. So you chose the counties and where you begin. How do you assess your progress? Because this was a huge operation and there were an awful lot of people. So you had to have videos and you had to have live feeds and you had to have people wired. You had to have people ready to go at any section. So how do you documented everything. How did you create the feeds and the live feeds and the videos? And explain how your team exchanged information. I mean, they weren't all together. So how did they communicate? How do you communicate when you're on a mission? In other words, they want to take down the marijuana ring. They want to get the leaders, but they're just about to take someone down. How do you communicate with somebody while you're doing that?
Well, there again, coordination and communication is key. And from the team, we work together on a daily basis. And we were going in different directions and following different leads, but then we would come back together at the office and things, and we would go over and put everything into an accumulation, a cumulative file, and to where you've got a big picture. We had maps on the walls that showed the areas that we had done. We kept notes and documentations of the wiretaps as it started off, and we were doing the initial part of the operation, and we were going back to your question, how do you judge your success? Well, in a marijuana eradication, it's kind of simple. You know, you judge it by how many fields did you find? How many plants did you seize? How many suspects were you able to arrest and bring before a judge? Those are key points as far as judging your success of the operation in a typical operation. But as someone read my book, and they could see, especially ones that had people that may have had they have experience in law enforcement, they could see that the operation in McDowell County was anything but typical. And it brought up a lot of suspicions and things that just didn't add up. And when, you know, at first, when these irregularities first started happening, you start to thinking, like, are they just being stupid or is there more to this? And then as these irregularities continue to happen, then you think, okay, it's no longer a coincidence. We're seeing a pattern. So you start documenting those patterns and you start figuring out how to investigate the irregularities as we did in this. And part of that comes from phone taps, and that requires court orders and things like that. We were fortunate enough to, in the book, to have an inside informant whose name was Reggie, who gave us tips and things, and gave us specific locations of where some of marijuana fields that was being operated and managed and financed by law enforcement personnel were located, and how they were kept away from the search areas. And so we were able to locate those fields based on his information, and then we set up remote cameras and things record basically constantly. As long as there's motion or activity, the motion and the activity sensors kick off the camera, and they start recording. And this is actually typically done in situations like that, where you can't stake out and sit in the woods indefinitely. So you set up remote cameras that record everything, and then these cameras that we were using also had the remote download capability. So we did not actually have to go back to physically touch and download the thing. We were able to do it remotely. You had to be within a certain distance of it. I mean, it had to be close enough, but you did not actually have to go back on site and put hands on the device to download it. So then as we were getting these, downloading the cameras, and as they record it, we carry it back, we review it over there, we see the people that are actually showing up at these marijuana fields and working them and tending them. We see how key law enforcement personnel are showing up at these fields and inspecting the progress, inspecting the work being done by the people that they've hired to do the work and to maintain them. And things. And there was also a point at one of the fields where they were using a mobile meth lab through a motorhome. And that is an actual practice that I have come across in my career, is that where meth labs was being very starting to grow in the late 90s into the early 2000s, meth was becoming more prevalent. And so people were doing meth labs in stationary locations. And as that became a problem with that, they could not move. And so a lot of meth labs were being found because you couldn't just pack up and move. So people were going to actually using motorhomes and converting that to mobile meth labs so that they could move from location to location to reduce the risk of being detected and apprehended. And all of that was incorporated into the book. Like I said, this is actual situations I encountered throughout my career. And by adding that into the thing, people hear about it in the news. They read about it in the paper. So being incorporated in my book, it made the realism even more believable.
I like Reggie, though. Did you know him?
Yes.
Sometimes you like the bad characters because they're really cool. So this is what got me. We have about 20 minutes. I'm looking at my clock here.
Okay.
When someone questions your authority, and you realize that some of the sheriffs were not up on their procedures for securing evidence, and you realize that some of them were not exactly on the up and up. What do you do when you realize that the people that are supposedly on your side are really not, and they're in exactly what they're trying to do, is get exactly what you're trying to stop? How do you
right.
deal with that?
We'll start with your first question about the questioning authority. Is that anytime that different agencies come together, a lot of times you run into that where, the ultimate question, like, well, who is ultimately in charge, comes up. And mm-hmm. when you start dealing with a federal task force like we had, obviously, whoever's in charge of the federal task force ultimately has isn't ultimately in charge because he has the jurisdiction. In real life, you see it both ways. You come across that where they butt heads, and it just doesn't work. But you hope, especially in real life most of the time, is that when you come to these points of differences, this is that you communicate, you talk it out, and you realize that you realize the bigger picture and what your ultimate objective is, and you still work together for the greater good. That's what you hope for. And a lot of times mm-hmm. that is what happens. Sometimes it isn't. I mean, that's just a personality conflicts. It goes back to what we talked about earlier, is that sometimes relationships present challenges. As far as with this particular situation where the sheriff and his deputies were actually involved in the manufacturing and the production of the controlled substances and the drugs. What they were doing, they were trying to utilize the task force, to eliminate the competitors, their competition. So that if they could use the task force to eliminate all the competitors and all their fields and all their labs, then the only ones left in that area would be forced to buy from the sheriff and his deputies, and that's how it came. You know, as the book unfolded, you saw that.
Yeah, I know. I did. It was like, oh my God! And how do you arrest somebody that's supposedly in law enforcement? That's kind of hard. So, how do you do that? How do you arrest somebody in law enforcement that is bad? That's an interesting question.
Well, there again, one has to realize, you hear it all the time, no one is above the law. The law is there for everyone, and that includes law enforcement. And you would hope that law enforcement holds themselves up to a higher standard, that they not only enforce the laws that they're sworn to enforce and uphold, but they live it in their personal lives. Unfortunately, that's not always true. And when you come across a suspicion of law enforcement being involved in criminal activity, you've got to have your I's and dotted, your T's crossed. You better have your evidence, because they're going to pull up when it comes to court. If you don't have all your an over preponderance of evidence, then they'll come out. They'll come off as like, well, all my years of service and things. And then you look into defamation of character situations and things. So you've got to have the evidence to make it without a doubt, without question, that they're guilty. Here's all this evidence that they cannot deny. They cannot skate around. They were breaking the law. They were arrested. And usually that's done through either indictments, federal warrants, and things like that. When you start arresting law enforcement, you go through indictments are handed down by grand juries, federal warrants are handed down by federal judges and things. If you're in the situation with this book where they were crossing state lines and it was not only nationally, it was internationally, then you have to get the federal authorities involved, because it goes back to the question of jurisdiction.
That makes it hard, because then you have different people to work with, or that could work against you too, because you don't know who's gonna work together with anybody and cooperate. So the character whose name I finally spelled right, is Theo. So how did you handle Theo and the other suspects until the final takedown? And this was related to the Mexican cartel. So how do you tie that all in?
Well, you know, there again, this, you know, Theo, as with the rest of the characters, was fictional. But there are real life examples of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were able to identify Theo as the crime boss of the network in that region through our investigation, through our documentation, through the telephone taps and things. And we were able to, and also Reggie's testimony and his evidence and his statements mm-hmm. that he gave. There again, an over preponderance, you know, things is, of the evidence. And, you know, it became very clear that Theo was the crime boss, and so we were able to target him specifically through phone wiretaps, through phone tapping mm-hmm. his phone and documenting his cell phone conversations. And that's how we were able to eventually realize that he was dealing with people in other states, that his network wasn't just mm-hmm. localized, that it had national and international reach, which involved the Mexican cartels. And it's just like any other real-life investigation. You just have to take it's a building block. You start at the foundation, and you work, and you keep building your wall till you get to the top. And that's how it was with this. I don't want to give away too much of the book. But I think if people will read the book, they'll be drawn into it as you were, and as other people have been. We keep it exciting and we keep it real. And, you know, it has led up to a very exciting and explosive climax that I don't think your readers mm-hmm. and listeners will be disappointed in.
Well, I will tell you this. This book is 143 pages. Seriously. And normally, I'm a speed reader. And I could read 5 to 6 books a week, or sometimes 3 a day if I have energy. And this book took me longer because it was a lot of pages, and I wanted to make sure that I got what the book was about. I said,
right.
No, before I ask my questions, I made to make sure and take my time. Usually, like I said, I start the book on Monday and I'm done by Tuesday. But no, I didn't. This is a longer book, and it had a lot more complicated things. And I always like to make sure that I get what the book is about, which I usually do. And I just haven't
mm-hmm.
had 5 minutes to sit down and write anything longer about it. So we have several other characters. We have a few minutes. And
yes.
There's always a boss in charge. So we have Reggie, and we have Jay, and we have Joey. And do these guys that are informants, do they ever worry that the big boss is going to find out and something's going to happen to them? I mean, wouldn't
Oh, absolutely, and that was explained with Reggie.
Two sides of the, I know, especially Reggie. I don't like Reggie. So they play two sides of the coin. How do they stay alive? I mean, how do they, you know, the police are supposed to protect them, but to a point they can't, I guess.
Right. And as far as Reggie goes, he'd been in it for so long and things, and he had seen other people who had outlived their usefulness, and basically the network eliminated them. And he didn't want to become another statistic. He realized that he needed to get out, and to get out of it and continue living and not be eliminated or be killed, he needed help. And he had a relationship with Jay, which was a member of our team, and who
mm-hmm.
Jay was very instrumental in introducing Agent Wagner to Reggie, and that was a very strong building block of the book as well as the investigation. And we did our best to protect Reggie throughout it, and at the end of it, he was put in the WITSEC, which is a witness protection or witness security,
mm-hmm.
And things, and was given a new life and a new identity and things. But you always, especially with a confidential informant, there's always that risk. And
mm-hmm.
you know, people would say, you know, what motivates a person to become an informant? Well, usually it's one of two things. They're either wanting, or actually three things. In Reggie, he wanted out. The other informants provide information, basically for monetary gain, because if it's a credible mm-hmm. tip and things, usually they receive some kind of monetary money and things for their service. And then other people get themselves in the bind, and they're trying to work, you know, they're trying to work a deal by cooperation mm-hmm. with law enforcement to lessen their sentence. And those are usually the three reasons people become informants. You know, Jay was a member of our team, and he came in later after Frank and Sandy and myself. He was the fourth member of the team, and then there were other members as the book developed. As far as Joey and Steve, they were DEA agents that was sent as undercover operatives. And that's just like that with myself in my real life. You know, they were police officers. They were law enforcement officers or DEA agents. And their job was, or that assignment was, to be an undercover operative. And we had Steve working one side of it and Joey working the other side to get, you know, to maximize our ability and opportunity to gather evidence.
Well, before I forget, this is exciting. On the 16th, I have Cindy McDonald, Fiona Quinn, the Fiona Quinn mm-hmm. murder, Mambo and murder. On the 17th, FBI agent Michael Tabman. We're going to talk about the government shutdown and the FBI investigation of the president. On the 21st, I have the author of A Good Man, and that should be interesting too. On the 22nd, I'm excited because I'm the guest. I'm going to be interviewed at 8 o'clock in the morning on KFC, 5:50 a.m. on the Brian Thomas Show, and they're going to talk to me about my book, A Daughter's Promise. A Daughter's Promise is never to put my mom in a nursing home when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and it's her true story and her words. So I'm excited. On the 24th, Derek Volk will be here. We're going to talk about A Chasing Rabbit, and talks about his son who has Asperger's autism. It's a very, very, very serious topic, and it's a very serious book. On the 28th, David Rosenfeld is going to be there with Deck the Hounds and Andy Carpenter. And to end the month, I'm really excited, Jean DeRosa, and we're going to talk about Dark Paradise. So that's just some, but I think I was really excited when on February 13th, Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child asked for an interview for Verses for the Dead. I'm like, oh my God, this is so exciting to be asked to do that. So that's just some of what MJ Network is up to. So, what the final is, how do you final takedown? How do you get it all together so that everyone gets, and do you always get the bad guys, or do some of them get away so that you get them next time? Or you have to hope that they don't find you next time?
As far as the final takedown, I don't want to give away too many details, but basically in real life, what you do is you do massive coordination and mm-hmm. through local and federal agencies and things. Make sure you have enough personnel to do the job as best you can to ensure the maximum success as far as apprehension of the suspects that you have warrants for. As far as do you always get the bad guy? You would like to think and hope that they do, but it's mm-hmm. been my experience and my personal opinion is you don't always get the bad guys, and there's no way to ever stop it. In my personal opinion, I know it's kind of oversimplified, but as long as you have people that are willing to purchase and buy these drugs, there's going to be those who are going to capitalize on the opportunity and continue to sell them. You get one off the street, there's always two more waiting to take mm-hmm. this place. Narcotic trafficking has been and narcotic use goes all the way back to, you know, hundreds of years, not just in the history of the United States, but even before. And it's all, you know, if anything, it's becoming more prevalent. So you do the best from a law enforcement standpoint. You do the best you can each day you go out. You work and you strive to do your job, your sworn duty, and do your investigations, get as many of them off as you can, because at the end of the day, you want you and your team to go home safe, but you also want to be able to sleep at night knowing you did the very best job you could.
Well, I'm looking at the last page of the book.
Okay.
It says it all, let me tell you. I'm not going to read it, but it says it all. The last page of the book lets you know exactly what we were sort of talking about. So before we end, you've got a new book coming out. It's called The Network Expanded, The Line in the Sand. And
exactly.
How does that continue from where you left off, or is this an entirely new investigation? Well, what is that about?
No, actually, it is a continuation, and it picks up where the first book leaves off. And I will go ahead and tempt you and your readers that the first book, you know, Network Exposed, the Line Between Badges, is the first book of a trilogy. There will be three books.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, wow.
The storyline is already set. The second book, The Line in the Sand, the title suggests what it's about, is that the team finds that the network is expanded. It's even larger than they thought. It has, you know, it's like an octopus. It has a lot more tentacles. And so, and then at some point in time, you know, they draw the line in the sand, you know, where do you cross the line and things. And I hope that the readers will love the first book. And if they do, they will definitely like the second book. And then the second book will lead into the third book of the third part of the trilogy. It will continue to be exciting, and they will draw me in. And I hope, if anything, that the second book will be even better than the first book, because we won't have as much of the character building, because the characters are already set. There will be new characters. There will be new situations, but it will just be an expansion and a continuation from the first book.
When is it coming out?
It's still in the writing process. I hope within the next 12 to 18 months, but I'm still in the writing process.
Okay. That's what I have to know. And before we end, could you tell everybody where they can find out about you and your work?
We have our website and things, which is bowagner.com. We also, you can find my book on Amazon. It's in Barnes and Nobles. If there are other, basically you go online, you can Google a network exposed the line between badges, and it'll pop up. There are several different outlets and things, including Life Rich Publishing. So the book is out there, storyline's out there. If you go to my website, you can read a little more about me and about the author. I hope that your readers and listeners will take the opportunity, be intrigued, and buy the book and things, and I hope they enjoy it.
Thank you so very much for today. And I might tag you before the 6 months to do one of my panel shows, because we do them on all sorts of different topics. What can I tell you? Yeah, I'm doing one on dialogue next month, and I'm doing one on setting. But sometimes I actually do it on real-life experiences in law enforcement, and there are enough law enforcement authors that I work with that it gets really interesting. So I want everyone, it's beautiful outside. It's freezing. It's 18 degrees over here. It's freezing, but that's okay. I want everybody to have a great day. Thank you both so very much. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Bye.